One of the issues that our office has been asked by the church to deal with in the last year is the death penalty. And the question is, should the American Lutheran Church, as have most other major denominations in the United States, take a position on the death penalty? It is one of the few major issues of our time and of the last few decades on which the ALC has not taken a stand. We still do not have a position on it. The LCA does. The Roman Catholics have had for many years, and the other major Protestant bodies do. But the ALC does not. The last time we looked at it as a church body was 1972, and the 1972 General Convention adopted a brief statement on capital punishment, which said, in essence, here are the arguments for it, here are the arguments against it. Individual believers will need to make up their own mind how they feel about it and communicate that to their legislators. That was in a time of reassessment of the death penalty. Because at that time, in that very year, in fact, 1972, the Supreme Court made a judgment that all of the existing death penalty statutes were unconstitutional. They were determined to be cruel and unusual punishment because of the way they were functioning and because of their lack of specificity and a variety of other reasons. And so in 1972, with one stroke, the Supreme Court ruled out the death penalty in the United States and then said, in effect, if the states want to have it, they're going to have to rewrite their statutes and start over, and that's what we've done. And since that time, in 12 or 13 years, 39 of the 50 states have readopted death penalty statutes. So it is back with us on the books, and there are 1,400 people currently on death row awaiting execution once their appeals run out. We're now in a situation where a lot of those appeals, that process of appealing, which you can extend for typically 10 years from the time of the commission of the crime, that process is running out for more and more. So we're going to have, it appears, a situation in which the cork is pulled, and we're going to have a torrent of executions in the next year or two, unless something happens to change all of that, but it appears unlikely. So you may have noticed lately in the press there are executions, it seems, sometimes almost weekly, back in the news. I think, in fact, they are becoming so numerous that they're non-news again, and they're being pushed back from the front page to the rear of the paper or not appearing at all. But we are, again, executing a lot of people. Well, what I would like to do in the time we have is to try to review some of the arguments about the death penalty on both sides of the issue and to tell you a little bit about the process that we have used in one church body to try to explore that by seeking to involve the people, the members of congregations, if they are interested. They all have had the opportunity to be involved in a study of a document which was prepared, not a proposed social statement of the church, but preliminary to that, really a piece of curriculum, a piece of study material that tried very hard to be fair to the arguments on both sides and to state the case as fairly as could be stated, both for and against the death penalty. And then we invited the congregational study groups who looked at it to respond by sharing in a written form their conclusions with the National Office of Church and Society. And we would, on the basis of those responses, then decide, that is, our standing committee, which is our elected governing board, would decide what next to do. Well, I'll come back to that and tell you what they have decided next to do. On the board behind me, and I might as well do this right now, is a summary of the responses that we had received through about the middle of May. I don't know if you can all see it, so I'll tell you what the figures are and give you some sense of the response. These are congregational responses on the death penalty stance of the church body that they would like to see. That was the question. What would you like to have your church body, the national denomination, the American Lutheran Church, say, if anything, on the death penalty? We basically gave them three options. The church should come out in opposition to the death penalty as the position of the ALC. the church should come out in support of the death penalty, or the church should reaffirm the 1972 statement, perhaps updating it, but basically do what we said in 72, which is not to take a stance, but to let individual believers decide on the basis of their weighting of the arguments for and against. The fact was that the responses included a fourth category. As they came in, there was a fourth category, which was basically none of the above, in which people said other kinds of things, or the groups themselves that studied it were split, or most commonly, they said, we don't want our church to deal with the death penalty in isolation from the broader issue of the criminal justice system and the way it is functioning in our society, which we do not feel good about. And that was virtually universal. Out of almost 350 formal study group responses that were received, I would say at least 300 of them made that point, including those who did vote for one of the other three options. They said, we have to look at this in the context of the larger criminal justice system, and both supporters of the death penalty and opponents of the death penalty took their position in many cases because of how they feel about the larger criminal justice system. Let me just quickly illustrate that. People who oppose the death penalty tend to use as one of the primary arguments that you cannot trust the present system to function fairly. It is very arbitrary in who gets executed. Out of all the people, all of the class who commit the same kind of crime and are judged to be guilty of the same crime, the same capital offense, almost always it's murder, only a small, very small percentage of them ever get the death penalty. Why is that? Well, we're going to look at that in a moment, what the figures say. And so people who oppose it say, among other reasons for opposing it, it is the arbitrary nature of it. The fact that it's a kind of a roulette, and you never know with any given commission of a crime for which death is in that state an appropriate penalty, whether that person's odds of getting the chair or the noose or the firing squad or whatever means we use to execute are very, very slim. That's one reason for people to oppose the death penalty who might otherwise be for it. Secondly, on the other hand, those who are for the death penalty say that they are for it because they don't trust the death penalty, they don't trust the criminal justice system to keep us safe and secure without it. If they had confidence that convicted murderers, dangerous, violent people, would not easily be released into society without assurance of rehabilitation of those persons, they would not be for the death penalty. But because they don't have that confidence, they're for the death penalty. Do away with those people to keep us, to keep me safe. Okay, so on both sides of the issue, you have people saying they are where they are because they don't trust the present criminal justice system to function effectively. Now, let me give you a summary of what these figures have told us. And we separated the data into two categories. Congregations in states with the death penalty, remember there are 39 of those currently, and congregations in non-death penalty states. Nationally, 39, and many of the big population states are among them, New York, California, etc. 39 states have the death penalty. Only 11 do not. However, the American Lutheran Church is distributed in such a way that almost half of its membership is in states without the death penalty. Nationally, it's only 18% of the population of the U.S., which is in non-death penalty jurisdictions, the 11 states plus the District of Columbia. But for the ALC, and I think it's an accident of geography more than anything else, some may want to read more into it than that, I don't. I certainly don't claim that because ALC people are strong in those states, they don't have the death penalty, because I think ALC people tend to be more in favor of the death penalty than their population as a whole in their states. But in those states live, where 18% of the U.S. population live about 50% of the ALC population. What are they? Well, I've got a map here which I can hold up. You may be able to get a little bit of sense of it. The solid states inked in are states without the death penalty as of the middle of 1984. If you know anything about the geography of the American Lutheran Church. This wouldn't be true of Lutherans as a whole. The LCA is distributed differently, and so is the LCMS. But the ALC is heavily concentrated in the five upper Midwest states. Over half of its population is there. All of them do not have the death penalty except South Dakota. South Dakota doesn't have it, does have it, but has nobody currently on death row, which is what the hatched diagonal lines mean. So Michigan was the first state in the U.S. to abolish the death penalty, by the way. Anybody know about when that happened? Anybody from Michigan? Your state abolished the death penalty in 1844. It was the first state in the Union to do it. And you have not had it since, but I understand currently there's a move on to restore it. That's what I'm told by people from Michigan. Another bit of inaccuracy, or a bit of inaccuracy here. Oregon has, since this map was prepared, just in the last year, reinstituted the death penalty. But I don't think Oregon has anybody on death row, and I think it's for fairly limited kinds of murder, not across the board. But Oregon is back in the column of the white states, those with the death penalty. So, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, North Dakota, Kansas, Michigan, all states with a substantial population of ALC people do not have the death penalty currently. So we come out with 194 congregations in death penalty states responded and 153 in non-death penalty responded. These are results in percentages. In the first question, should the church oppose the death penalty? In death penalty states, only 14.4% of the responding groups, these are group responses, however the congregations organized it. With a Sunday morning study, the curriculum was set up for four sessions. Most of them used at least four Sundays. Did any of you participate in the study in your places? You did in Burnsville, okay. Where was yours?
Washington.
In Washington State? Okay. 14.4% of those study groups in death penalty states said that's what the church should say. 36.6% of them in death penalty states said the church should support the death penalty. That was the plurality in death penalty states, almost 3-1. In non-death penalty states, however, the plurality said the church should support opposition, should oppose the death penalty, or support abolition of the death penalty, 31.4% versus 23.5%. Not as great a margin, but still a plurality for opposition to the death penalty. So if you compare these two, you see the contrast. From 14% to 31%, and from 36 or 7% down to 23% between the two categories, death penalty and non-death penalty states. To me, that says our congregations, at least to some degree, correlate in how they think about that issue with the practice of their own state. And I think that's to be expected. I think the correlation is somewhat greater than I expected, but it's remarkable, I think, that there is a correlation that is that striking. Overall, then, of all the 347 responses, about 22% said the church should come out in opposition to the death penalty, and about 31% said the church should come out in support of the death penalty. However, these first two lines represent only half of the responses. That's why there's not a majority for either of the options, because a strong, almost equal response in totality was the 28.5% who said we should reaffirm the 72 statement, which is in essence not to take a position, to leave it to individual believers to take a position, but the church body should not. Now, some of that is a result of people's feeling, and it's still very strong, that church bodies shouldn't take positions on any social question. Some of it was that. I think the majority of it was not that. It was just that this is such an issue of division that we can't agree, and so the church body shouldn't claim to speak for, you know, what is a slight majority one way or the other. That is, there is no genuine consensus in our congregation or in our church body as a whole, so we shouldn't take a position. And I think that's a responsible stance to consider. The fourth option, which is other, I've already commented on, that came out close to 20% said something else, like don't look at this in isolation from the criminal justice system, or the groups themselves were so split that they didn't have a strong preference for one position or another. I have the congregational totals for each of those, if any of you is interested in that kind of data. Now, let me move on and say something about the climate in this country and how it has changed over the last 15 years. If you've followed this issue, you've been aware of that. And I think it also tells us how court decisions do reflect the climate, the political climate in the country, and I don't think that's bad. I think it is good that Supreme Court justices know what's going on in the general political climate of the nation. In the late 60s, there was a lot of concern that the death penalty, as it was functioning then, was falling unfairly on the poor and on non-whites. And all of the statistics bear that out. They still do, in fact. That's still the case. But in the late 60s, it was part of the general concern of the civil rights movement, and one of the civil rights organizations, the NAACP, made as one of their major agenda items the addressing of the death penalty in an effort to get it abolished. So that you have, I think the statistics in that sheet are gathered by the NAACP, aren't they? They are still at work on that issue. But there was a concern then that the way it was functioning was unfair. And so there was concern in the general society, and the polls at that time of all of us, the cross-section Gallup polls and so on, indicated fairly strong support for abolishing the death penalty. It was like 65 to 35 back in the late 60s and early 70s. Well, what is the case today? What would you guess? Maybe you know. Maybe you've followed it. What do you think has happened? 65%. It's at least reversed. The latest poll I've seen, January of 85, said 85% of the American public believes we should have the death penalty across the country. That's the highest it's ever been, and that's about the highest that polling gets on any kind of question. To get 85% to agree with any public policy issue or position is just highly unusual. Well, that's kind of scary, because I think what it says is people are angry, people are fearful, people are frustrated about violent crime and don't know what to do, and so they grab onto the death penalty as one way, one symbol of getting tough. I think that's what it's saying. Because most people, when they study the data of how it actually functions and the fact that very few committers of violent crime are ever executed, they say, well, yeah, I guess the death penalty is more of a symbol than an actual deterrent or an actual, fact, the evidence is pretty strong for my mind, at least, that it doesn't deter. The incidence of violent crime is highest precisely in the states that have the death penalty. And the states that execute the most people have the highest incidence of violent crime. So it's almost an inverse correlation of what you'd expect if you believe the deterrent argument. The states that don't have the death penalty and haven't had it for a long time, like Minnesota and Michigan, have a relatively low incidence of violent crime. Okay, that's getting a little bit ahead of the story because I didn't want to deal with the deterrence argument quite yet. There has been a great fickleness among us in our response to the death penalty, how we feel about it. And just in a 15-year period, we have flip-flopped from 2-to-1 support for abolishing the death penalty to what is today something like 6-to-1 support for reinstituting it or retaining it. Demographics of that tends to be stronger support in the states that have it than in states that don't have it, but even in states that don't have it, like my own state, Minnesota, the polls currently say it's about 2-to-1 support for the death penalty. So if you submitted it to a referendum of the Minnesota voters right now, Minnesota would have the death penalty. The legislature has not talked about reinstituting it, and I don't know of any organized effort to do so. But Oregon did have one in the past year, and who's from Oregon here? Anybody? You have now reinstituted, I understand. Do you want to say a word about that? It was a referendum of the voters. So the statute hasn't yet been adopted, but the voters have approved it. Do you remember the margin in the referendum? Okay. Another thing about the demographics of it is it's one of the clearest areas of margin between clergy and laity. I don't know if you're familiar with that as a general phenomenon. On many social questions today in most churches, certainly in the Lutheran churches, the clergy and the laity as a group are at different points. That is, the proportions of laity and clergy who support or oppose a particular public policy strategy vary dramatically. And some say the gap is growing, and that's a matter of concern for the health and wholeness of the church. I know it's a concern for many laity who tend to feel that their clergy almost always, without exception, are well to the left of them on things political. I think as a collectivity, that is a true statement. But on this issue, there's a bigger gap than on almost anything else. On abortion, what to do about nuclear arms, Central America, whatever. The gap is just immense. And among Lutheran clergy, it's something like 90% opposition to the death penalty. Among Lutheran laity, it's almost the same as the society as a whole, about 80% support for the death penalty. Now, I don't know what that says to you, but I think it's at least something we have to talk about together as clergy and laity. We have to be aware of it, we have to deal with it, and we have to try to reflect on what the reasons for that may be. I'm not proposing we do that right now, but maybe in some discussion time we could. Well, college students, 1984, survey of college freshmen on their social attitudes. This is done every year among entering freshmen across the country, and they get whatever freshmen respond to it, and they total up close to 200,000 responses last year, and then they compare it year by year with how entering freshmen are changing in their views on many issues, from the legalization of marijuana to abortion to the death penalty. Last year, 58% of entering freshmen said, no, I'm sorry, 26% of entering freshmen said they favored abolition of the death penalty. In 1971, 13 years before, 58% were for the abolition of death penalty. So there you, again, you've got that dramatic shift, 58% favoring abolition down to 26% favoring abolition. What about history? The death penalty has been used throughout history, of course, for all sorts of crimes. Historians of Great Britain talk about how in the old days there were public hangings for pickpocketing. And the incidence of pickpocketing always went up at the public hangings. That is, people would come to the public hangings and pick pockets while they were watching people being executed for picking pockets. In the Bible, of course, it was used for adultery. It was used for other crimes. Let me read some of those to you. In the Old Testament, if you don't know the Old Testament very well, as I don't, you will be, I think, surprised to hear the list of offenses for which you could be killed. And I'm referring to the study material as I quote from this document, and of that I do have copies for all of you, or at least every couple of you, and I'll hand those out at the end so that you listen to me while I'm talking, but you may take them with you. The Old Testament code prescribes the death penalty for many offenses we would consider vastly disproportionate. Striking or cursing one's father or mother. Rebellion of teenagers. A woman who is unchaste at her own wedding. Adultery, of course. You remember that from the New Testament story. And the oppression of strangers, widows or orphans. All of the biblical citations are in this paragraph. And then the writer of this material goes on to ask, how could someone appeal to the Old Testament code as a support for using the death penalty on murders while rejecting that same code when it prescribes the same penalty for adulterers, rebellious teenagers, and so on? And he concludes, this writer concludes, there is clearly no way to use the Old Testament code as a proof text to support use of the death penalty today. In other words, if you're going to use it, you have to be consistent and then apply it to all the crimes, all the offenses that the Old Testament applies it to. The writer says there are other good arguments for the death penalty, but he doesn't think the Old Testament support for it is one. And he appeals rather to Jesus' response when asked. The one time Jesus was asked about the death penalty was in the story of the woman taken in adultery. And while you could say, well, Jesus' response to that question wasn't centrally a response to the question about the death penalty, at least you have to consider that text, that story, I think, as a part of the biblical material that you deal with. The other thing is that it has always struck me as I've looked at the death penalty literature how, in a strange kind of way, for Christians, the death penalty itself is at the heart of our faith. Ed Schrader was referring to it in the Bible study this morning, how we are all under the death verdict, how Jesus Christ was under the death verdict, how the central symbol in most of our churches is the instrument of capital punishment, the cross. It's an instrument of capital punishment. And we wear it around our necks as jewelry, and we have it in our churches as a symbol, and which it is, of the deepest meaning of our faith, the theology of the cross itself. But have you ever thought about what it would be like to walk into your church next Sunday and to see there, instead of a cross, an electric chair suspended in the chancel, or a gas oven, or what, a noose, some instrument of executing people legally, which modern states use? Well, the geography of it, it's virtually gone in modern democratic societies. That's one of the ironies, I think, about our situation in the United States. In many ways, one of the leading nations in the world in the social legislation that is progressive. Well, this is one area where we are not progressive, if progressive means to abolish the death penalty. It is gone in Israel. That's interesting, because the state of Israel is based, at least to some extent, on the what we call the Old Testament provisions for social order. But the state of Israel does not have the death penalty. It is gone in all of Scandinavia and has been for quite some time. It's gone in West Germany. It's gone in the rest of Western Europe, in the United Kingdom, in Ireland, in France, in Italy. It's gone in Canada. It's gone in Mexico. It's gone in Nicaragua. One of the first things the Sandinistas did was to abolish capital punishment, and they have not used it since their revolution in 1979. It remains chiefly where? Well, in the United States, in the Soviet Union, in South Africa, in Iran, and in many other Muslim-dominated countries. The Muslims still use the death penalty for quite a few crimes. At least it's on their statute books. Who gets executed? Today, it is predominantly, like 99%, males. Less than 1% of those executed are females. And yet that is not the proportion of crimes. And I think this is a kind of sexism at work. And you can explore in your own mind what the reasons for it are. But less than 1% of those we execute in the United States over the past period of years have been women. And yet women commit 30% of the murders, which is another way of saying we don't execute all murderers. We pick and choose. I think juries have been less willing to condemn women to death than men for the same kind of crime. There was one celebrated recent example, and criminologists have reflected on it and think that one of the reasons that she was executed was that state, which had many people on death row, had to show that they did not make an exception for a woman. It was a woman in North Carolina who poisoned a couple of people. Remember that story? It was in the heat of the campaign year 84 when the governor who had to make the decision, Jim Hunt, was running for Senate against Jesse Helms. And it became a major issue in that Senate campaign. And there are those who believe that Hunt's decision ultimately was influenced, at least in part, by the fact that it had implications for the political campaign that he was in, because his opponents were using it against him and would have if he had commuted her sentence. The interesting thing about that case was everybody agreed that she had been rehabilitated. From all evidence, she had become a Bible-believing, a born-again Christian, as she put it, while in prison. She was now safe. She was now okay to release back into society even, much less keep in prison for a life sentence. But she was executed. But that's a rarity. Most of the people executed are males. Most of those males are economically marginal. They do not have financial resources. the middle class and wealthy males hardly ever get executed. And they are males who are poor, who kill white people in the southeast of the U.S. There's a geography about the death penalty as well, not only about the states that have it or don't have it, but about the death penalty. Half of the 1,400 currently on death row are in five states. Do you know which state leads in numbers on death row and therefore in executions currently? Florida.
Florida leads all the rest. Then the other four are two other southeastern states, Georgia and Alabama, and two large population states, California and Texas. Those five have over half of the people on death row. More than 54% of the executions since 1930 have been minority group members, and yet minority group members have not committed 54% of the capital crimes. They've committed capital crimes disproportionate to their numbers. You say 11% or 20%, however you figure, minority. The minority involvement in capital crimes may be something like 30 or 35%, but it is not 54%. So there appears also to be some racism at work, in addition to some classism. Let me quote from a lawyer on how this death penalty roulette works in his mind. He made this statement in 1984. If you have 10 male convicted murderers, 10 convicted of murder, capital crime, and remember, it's only murder for which we use the death penalty these days. We used to use it for rape, rape without murder in rape. In some states, that's pretty well been eliminated. It may still be on the statute books, but I don't think there are any currently on death row for the crime of rape. Theoretically, it is still available for treason, but the last time the U.S. federal authority used it for treason was the Rosenberg. Remember the Rosenberg case after, well, I guess in the late 40s, early 50s. It's also on the books in military justice. The Code of Military Justice provides for the death penalty for things like even desertion, treason, but it is not, it has not been used, I think, since World War II. So if you have 10 convicted murderers, all of whom are male, because to get a woman in there, you'd have to have 100, and then you'd have one woman in the group. If you have 10 convicted murderers, they are all male. You pick three names out of a hat. Three of these 10 are chosen. One then is eliminated because he is white. That is, seven of the 10 don't even get the death sentence, or don't even get considered for the death sentence. Then you eliminate one of the remaining three because he is white, and one because the murder victim is not white, because we execute very few people who kill non-whites. We cannot say that the remaining murderer, the one who is executed, has gotten his just desserts. This is the data in our system of administering the death penalty, where people are not being executed exactly for their crime, but on a crooked lottery. That's how he refers to it, as a crooked lottery. Well, there's a certain dilemma in that. You could argue the way to make the crooked lottery straight or clean is to execute more people, right? Treat everybody who is guilty of the same offense the same way. That would be one way to establish fairness in the system, to get away from the arbitrariness. But as soon as you do that, what happens? Or what is more likely to happen? Say if you execute instead of 1,400 on death row, 14,000 on death row, and those 14,000 are all executed in the next half decade. What is more likely to increase? Well, perhaps public revulsion would increase. I think that's a likely possibility. But in terms of fairness, what is likely to happen? Killing somebody who doesn't deserve it, even under the state's own definition of just desert. The possibility of making a mistake increases as you increase the numbers. And, of course, one reason we don't execute very many of that population who are all guilty of the same crime is precisely that. We want to be so sure we don't make a mistake. So that's the dilemma you're in. And I think there is a good summary statement of that in here, too, that I can find and share with you. The dilemma is this. To the extent that society tries to be careful and fair in administering the death penalty, it will inflict it so rarely as to render it almost meaningless as a tool of criminal justice. As relatively speaking, it is now almost meaningless. I think it's meaningful mostly as a symbol. It's meaningful if you're one of the few who gets executed, of course. But as a tool of criminal justice, it's relatively meaningless. However, if society tries to correct this problem by inflicting it more frequently, it guarantees that more errors will be made and more innocent persons executed. The same lawyer quoted above, the one who talked about the 10 persons, says this: so long as we're careful to make as few errors as possible, we're also going to let most of the ones who deserve the penalty, in quotes, slip through the net. And the ones who are left to die will be executed not because of what they did, but because they were the wrong color, or they killed someone popular or powerful, or because they couldn't afford a competent lawyer, or because they just weren't lucky. Okay, where are we legally today? The court in 1972, the Supreme Court ultimately said the present death penalty statutes were all wrong, unconstitutional, and had to be replaced if the states wanted to have the death penalty. Then in 1976, in a series of decisions, the Supreme Court ruled that the penalty of death is not as such unconstitutional, provided its imposition meets clear objective standards. And that's what the states have tried to meet in their rewriting of capital punishment statutes since 1976. Those are now being tested in the courts. And it may be that in the next few years, another kind of decision will be at the Supreme Court level. Okay, what are some of the arguments for it? Let me just summarize this. I think we've already alluded to a few of those. One is purely we need to get tough. And one way of getting tough and showing that we need to get tough as a society about crime is to have the death penalty on the books. Even if we don't use it all that often, we have it on the books. And related to that is the argument that we need to stop the crimes of violence. And one way to do that is to use the ultimate penalty for those who commit crimes of violence. That's basically the deterrence argument. I think the bottom line for all people who support the death penalty is, well, even if it doesn't deter others, even if it doesn't accomplish anything to change the incidence of violent crime, at least one thing is certain: this criminal will not do it again. And that's certainly true. If you do away with that life, that person will not again take another life, okay? I think that's unassailable, and that's an argument. What about the arguments against? Well, all of the evidence is, and all of the testimony from criminologists, and I'll read you a quote in a minute from a group of them in Florida, all of the evidence is that it doesn't deter. But in fact, almost without exception, people who commit crimes of violence don't stop and think about the possibility that they may have to be eliminated as the consequence of that. In fact, those who talk about it say the odds are pretty good. Even if you do stop to think about it, your odds of getting sent to execution are so minimal and so almost incidental that that's not an issue. Furthermore, most of the crimes of violence are committed under two sets of circumstances. One is domestic violence, killing a person you know in a violent argument. A spouse, a child, a parent, somebody you're related to or very close to. I think it's about 40% of the murders, of the homicides in this country, happen under those circumstances. And in the heat of that kind of passionate, ultimate violence, it appears that people do not stop and think about, well, does my state have the death penalty or not? And what are the percentages about my getting the chair? The other large category of murders is committed in acts of armed robbery, many of them drug-related. And often people are so intent on getting what they're after, the money to get drugs, that they apparently do not stop and think about the deterrence factor. The irreversibility of it, I think, is another major argument. You just cannot, unlike other sentences, you cannot undo the penalty of death once it's done, if you did make a mistake. or if that life would have been redeemable in human terms. For me, the ultimate, I guess, argument from a faith perspective is that if the concern is violence and breaking the cycle of violence, it does not seem faithful to the Bible to me to say that the way you break the cycle of violence is to do more violence. I just, whether we were talking about war and peace or we were talking about capital punishment or abortion for that matter, do you break the cycle of violence by doing another act of violence? Or to state it another way, do you teach people that to kill people is wrong by killing people? Or do you kill people who kill people in order to show that killing people is wrong? That is, do you legally kill somebody who has illegally killed somebody in order to show that killing people is wrong? And I think that's a key question that we all have to wrestle with. Now, one more thing, and then I will throw it open for discussion. One of the things we did in this material is to show the positions on the issue of two church bodies. The ALC, 1972, brief statement, doesn't take a position, and the LCA position of 1966, I think it is, 1968, which is a position in opposition to the death penalty, 1966, adopted by the Third Biennial Convention of the Lutheran Church in America. It is a relatively brief statement also, and it comes out against the death penalty. We did that because we thought it would be good for people in our study to see what another close-kin church body had said on the issue, and also to show that as we move toward new church, these two Lutheran bodies, together with AELC, which does not have a position on the death penalty, it's good to know what those you're going to marry up with have said on key issues of our time. And so we got responses from ALC congregations saying two kinds of things. We ought to adopt the LCA position against the death penalty. That's where our group came out. We're comfortable with it. And on the other hand, we had groups saying, if that's what the LCA believes, I don't want to merge with them. In other words, I don't want their position to be our position. So that raises the question, what will this new church's position be on social questions? And the answer to that is, the new Lutheran Church in the United States, beginning January 1, 1988, if that schedule is met, will have no positions on any social issue until it adopts its own. Now, that will give great comfort to some people. That will leave some other people kind of restless. How can we deal with the arms race until our church has a position on it? I don't think it's something that ought to trouble us at all, because that new church will have a history. It'll have a history of its predecessor pre-marriage bodies and what they said on a variety of issues. And on some of those issues, the three churches agree, essentially. On some of those issues, the three churches do not agree. On some of the issues, one or two churches have spoken and the third has not. Okay, that's all right. That's part of our history. That's what we go into the marriage with. It's part of the dowry. The new church then, over a period of years, decades, maybe centuries, will have to work out its own position collectively on whatever issues are facing the society at that time. And I think that's just fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But this is one area where one church, the LCA, has a position in opposition to the death penalty, and the other two have no position. The AELC has few positions on social issues because it's a very young body and just hasn't had the time in a decade to adopt positions on a lot of questions. It does have almost essentially the same position as the other two bodies on the nuclear arms race, which is basically that nuclear war can never be fought, that the goal of the world should be to abolish nuclear weapons, and that in the meantime, the deterrent strategy can be used, can be kept in place, as long as we work to reduce the weaponry to the point eventually of zero. But that should be the goal that the church has worked for. And that in the meantime, we're very troubled about the deterrent strategy, too, because of the ethical dilemma it puts us in. The three churches on that issue are essentially saying the same thing. On abortion, differences of nuance. On some other issues, as I said, some churches have spoken and others have not. We don't need to go into that any more deeply. But It did raise that question. What will the position of the new Lutheran Church be on capital punishment? And the answer is it won't have a position itself. It'll have predecessor body positions, but it won't have its own position until it adopts a position. I said I would read to you also on the deterrence matter the statement from the University of Florida criminologists. These are the people who are academically involved with criminal justice at the University of Florida. September 4, 1984, they made this statement. On numerous occasions, Florida's Governor Graham, the one who always has to decide in every case, shall this person go to execution or not, and remember Florida has the most, Governor Graham has stated that his fundamental rationale for capital punishment is to reduce the state's homicide rate. As criminologists at the state's leading university, we feel a professional and ethical obligation to report that there is no credible research that supports the contention that the threat or use of the death penalty is or has been a deterrent to homicide. Other justifications of capital punishment are possible. However, whether or not the death penalty reduces the homicide rate is an empirical question which cannot be answered on moral or political grounds. The question has been clearly answered by numerous research projects conducted over the last 50 years. This deterrence research does not provide a legitimate basis for our state's death penalty policy. This statement is endorsed by the entire faculty of criminologists at the University of Florida, September 4, 1984. There's one other argument for the death penalty which I do want to allude to before we go into general discussion, and that is the simple argument of dealing with society's anger. That is a legitimate social role that a society has to have played. It has to be dealt with somehow, and that the penalty of death is one way of dealing with society's very real and very intense anger. And there are people who have written on that philosophically and theologically who believe that's a legitimate concern. It's close to the idea of vengeance. It has nothing to do with deterring. It has to do with dealing with the very real anger of people and the anger of society about homicide apparently is not dealt with adequately for a lot of people by a life sentence where, especially when within 12 to 15 years, that person can be out and can do it again. That, I think, is what people feel most strongly. If a life sentence were truly a life sentence, or if people released were, in a much higher percentage of the cases, responsible social beings again, then they could abide the life sentence as an alternative. But people don't feel that the present system works that way. Some of the states, I have to tell you, who have reinstituted the death penalty have reinstituted it only for very limited kinds of homicide. And this may be a compromised way to go. There are three special cases that some states have written into their statutes. Murder by a prisoner serving a life sentence already. If society had no leverage of being able to threaten further punishment, this person is already serving a life sentence, what more can you do by adding another life sentence? The lifer could act with impunity and be more of a danger to guards, to inmates, and to others. So some states have gone that route, using the death penalty only for one who's already been convicted of a capital crime and has done it again. Secondly, murder of a police officer or judge or governor or president or lawmaker, some public person, while that person is carrying out official duty, an assassination attempt on the president, or an assassination successful on the president, or because of the office he or she holds. Assuming special responsibility and danger for the common good deserves special protection. And the third special case that some say we should have the death penalty for is treason. Treason is the ultimate offense against the nation, jeopardizing the security of all citizens. The potential traitor may not be deterred by the threat of imprisonment, for he or she believes that when the nation is liberated, in quotes, by the enemy, the imprisonment will be over. So those are some special cases that people who generally oppose the death penalty say we need it for those exceptions. Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left. Who wants to speak? Dean? Yes, there are some conservative evangelical groups, they would usually be called or categorized as. I think the Christian Reformed Church, based and located heavily in the Grand Rapids area of Michigan, and in parts of Iowa too, Herman. There are a lot of Dutch Reformed, Christian Reformed up in the northwest of Iowa. Well, the Reformed Church in America is a different group, and somewhat more liberal in its social stance, and I don't think they have come out for the death penalty. But the last time I looked, the Christian Reformed Church in America is on record as supporting the death penalty, at least as an option for the state. Now, one other thing I could say on that point is Christian tradition generally, including the Lutheran tradition, has said two things. The state clearly has the power to take life. It has the power of the sword. It can legally take life. Whether in war, you accept the law of nations, or in executing people who commit capital crime. Does it have the right? Well, the Augsburg Confession, to cite one denominational confessional statement, says yes, the state has the right to take life. I think the third question to ask is, does it have the need? That is, does it serve society? Is it desirable? The question for this session, is it desirable, even if the state has the power and the right, does it have the need to do it? Does it serve any useful social purpose? And I would answer that question for myself by saying no, it does not. It does not serve a useful social purpose. And so you might raise those three questions about it. Does the state have the power? I think, yes, it does. Does it have the right? Some would say no to that. Mennonites, Anabaptists, those who have as a part of their creed opposition to all forms of violence, have also said no to the death penalty universally. Other Christian groups, the more mainline majority groups in terms of numbers, have usually supported the death penalty historically. But in the 20th century, most of the mainline groups in the U.S. have come out against it, including the Roman Catholics. But there are still a few, like the Christian Reformed, that support it.